Welcome to Shelf Life, a podcast from the Newberry Library about the humanities and the humans behind them. I'm Alex Teller, Director of Editorial Services at the Newberry. In this episode...
Because Chicago in particular has such a strong sense of history, there's that kind of desire to connect with that. But as also, as I like to tell people, anyone who listens, students, people, places where I give my talks, Chicago's also really good at capitalism, which requires creative destruction.
Cities are constantly changing, and they evade our best efforts to make complete portraits out of them. To understand cities, sometimes you need to hunt down traces of the past that are as fragmentary as our daily urban experiences. Max Grinnell, aka the Urbanologist, is just the person to piece these fragments together. Max spoke with Jamie Waters, the Newberry's communications coordinator, in our special collections reading room while researching Chicago's Dill Pickle Club. The two discussed the informal, unsanctioned space that the Bohemian group carved out for itself, and how the fate of the Dill Pickle and other urban vestiges speaks to a complicated cycle of rebirth and renewal in the city.
Max, what is an urbanologist, and what does it mean to do urban studies?
Thanks for having me, first of all, Jamie. Great to be here. Urbanologist is someone who looks at and examines the urban condition through field studies, going out there on the street, talking with people about how they experience cities, and also works with archives, works with historical documents to create a multi-layered, interdisciplinary portrait of cities. And I've done it for over 20 years, and it never gets old. And it's exciting to think about how I can take work with colleagues and students to kind of better understand the richness of cities that way.
Okay. So when you're studying cities, what's your aim? What are you trying to understand?
My primary goal has always been to understand how historical trends in cities, whether it's transportation, the movement of people throughout different neighborhoods, whether it's bright light entertainment districts, how do they come together to make a complete city? So really bringing them all together in a way that is accessible both to the general public and scholars. I always assume, and I always tell my students, is that given that we're in such a busy landscape every day, that no one really has to care unless you give them a reason to care. Mm-hmm. So kind of creating an exciting story, and whether it's a neighborhood in Chicago, whether it's a public space in Seattle, how do we get people excited about that and on board? Kind of really creating converts, I guess you say.
Okay. Converts to the urban environment?
Converts to the urban environment, absolutely.
So it makes sense that you do a lot of walking tours, you walk around cities a lot, sort of anthropological. How does the archives come into what you do?
Archives give that scholarly and academic rigor to, I might walk by a building. This morning, I was walking on North Clark Street, which is part of an upcoming project of mine in the Near North Community area, popularly known as River North in Chicago. And I walked in front of two different buildings, 416 North State Street, one of my favorites, that thousands of people walk by every day. And probably, if they think about anything, they think about the fact that the sidewalk's broken over there. And they pass by. And then another building on North Clark Street, which is now Maggiano's. And those buildings have a very kind of rich history in kind of the rumbly, tumbly history of the River North area, which is now, gentrified and changed a lot. So thinking about those buildings, their place, their architecture, the past inhabitants really brings, that's kind of how I get started. And I say, how can we flesh out this story? So I come back to the archives. And of course, we're so lucky to have so much stuff that's digitized. I'm old enough as a Gen Xer to remember when you had no choice, and I cut my teeth at the Harold Washington Library Center and the University of Chicago Special Collections, where I went to college and I still teach. So coming back to look at those past archives, as opposed to just, it's great to be online, but it's also there's kind of that communion with a document that brings you a kind of a closer relationship with that place. Mm-hmm. So those are two buildings that I'm very excited about right now.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about, or just now we talked about how you were trying to flesh out this story. So you've pulled a bunch of stuff from the Dill Pickle archives. What kind of ephemeral interactions can you find from that, and how do you flesh out the story?
The Dill Pickle Club started in 1917 by Jack Jones. It's part of Chicago's flowering of really its most well-known literary period in the 20th century in terms of a group of people who came together in a physically proximate neighborhood with similar interests, poets, bohemians, some revolutionary doctors like Dr. Ben Reitman. These people all came together in what is now Tower Town, which is the area right around where we are at the Newbery Library. You know, there were tea houses, there were old walk-up buildings. There were kind of places that had been left behind by older, wealthier residents that had been repurposed. The story of cities throughout the ages, whether it's, you know, Paris, Chicago, you name it. So they had come together to form this club. And as the head of the club, he decided, well, we're going to have a series of lectures, poetry conversations, and kind of really get people excited. And actually, one of the things I found was a handbill describing the charter of the Dill Pickle Club. So I'd like to read a little excerpt from that for folks. The Dill Pickles were chartered in 1917 by the state of Illinois as a nonprofit organization for the promotion of arts, crafts, literature, and science. That's basic mission of what they did. And looking through their handbill, there's a couple hundred in the Newbery's collection, gives us a sense of what were they doing on a regular basis. And to provide a bit of historical context for this, of course, at this time in the teens, 20s, 30s, most people did not go to college, maybe eighth grade or high school. And so kind of people who gathered near to kind of have these kind of conversations that now we might associate happening online. People would come together and talk about, you know, sex in society, should marijuana be legalized? And they would come together to have these conversations.
So was the Dill Pickle Club a physical space, or was it more of an attitude? Like, what was the nature of it?
I like how you put that. I think it was a physical space and an attitude. It was the actual address is off of Dearborn Street, 10 Tooker Place. A street, you know, 1,000 feet maybe where we are now. The building does not exist anymore. And there's some photographs in the files that give you a sense of it was a small, basically stable. So not the kind of place you'd expect highbrow activities would happen. And you would walk in and, you know, different times during the club's 15 or so year history, there might be a tea room. There might be a stage set up for plays by Theodore Dreiser, people trying out new one acts. So it really was... We now have kind of more lofty aspirations of arts, cultural center. Have to remember at this time period, government support for these things, almost zero. It was patrons of the arts. And in the Midwest, most of those people, as in other places, chose to give their money to established institutions, the Art Institute of Chicago and other places. Who's going to, you know, give a few hundred, few thousand bucks to this group of ragtag bohemians? So they... Catch as catch can, they set up in this older space in the near north side and started to do their thing.
Right. What kind of contribution to civic life does that make? Like, how does that interact with the whole urban environment?
I think what the Dill Pickle Club did for Chicago, and there were predecessor art colonies as well, too. The art colony on 57th Street that was established right around the time of the Columbian Exposition and was there for 65 years. Old Town, of course, is another good example of this. They give the city that kind of informal place for not just socializing, but kind of conversation about arts and culture. It's great to go into, you know, a fancy, wonderful neoclassical building, you know, sanctioned by, you know, wealthy philanthropists and investors. But there's also kind of that, and we see that today in Chicago as well, too, also that place for informal, less structured opportunity. Here's this older building. You walk, you know, as they say, you step low and you'd come into the Dill Pickle Club. And of course, we have no radio recordings. We have no other recordings of it, but it's still very much a part of the city's consciousness. And actually now there's a Dill Pickle organization in Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. of all places that kind of seeks to capture that kind of bohemian cosmopolitanism in the city. And now, of course, in 2017, you could find a million groups like this, but it was quite novel and almost nothing remains today of Tower Town. It's all, you know, kind of upscale living, single room occupancy hotels are gone. But the Dill Pickle really gave it that kind of sense of here's this kind of unsanctioned, informal space. And as a result, Dill Pickle Club doesn't show up in the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Daily News or the other papers of the period because it's on the fringes, mm-hmm. which I think is really great.
That is really interesting. So what does remain? You said there aren't very many recordings, but we have all these records. So, like, what are they?
Well, it's interesting. I'm sitting in front of a few of them right now with you. We have programs about some of their plays. I'll take a look at this document from 1927, which announces to us the Dill Pickle Clubhouse and Chapel. It always had different names, and one of the controversies among literati is, was it Dill Pickle with one L or two L's? We won't get into that.
Yeah.
It's too
very
intense.
Fraught.
Very yeah. fraught with problems. But they announced 3 one-act plays, Theodore Dreiser's The Girl in the Coffin, which was not a household play name then or now, even though Theodore Dreiser, of course, is well known. Pendleton King's Cocaine, Pedrick Pierce's The Singer, Weeknights, 8:30 p.m. And there's a little drawing on it of where Tooker Place was for the uninitiated, pre-Google Maps, obviously. And at the bottom it says, well worthwhile. So it gives you one sense of what one of the activities that would have been going on there.
We'll put some of these documents on the website when we upload the podcast. So if you are curious and want to see them, we'll have an image for you.
And one that also is, they weren't afraid of shying away from some of the more controversial political issues of the time as well. I have in my hand an announcement for a January 4th lecture from 1925 that promises Elmer L. Williams discussing, will Chicago elect a racketeer mayor? With Thompson, Barrett, Lyle, Albert, Cermak, the friends and enemies of these candidates will raise a row that no pineapple explosion could drown. Jack Jones' first choice is Al Capone, second, Thompson. Jack Jones being the president of the Dill Pickle Club. And while you will know Al Capone, some folks might know that was he referring to William Hale Thompson, the mayor of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the same brochure also promises a other variety of conversations and discussions. And again, these were, you know, if you were an adult these times and kind of a, say we say a free thinker, you'd come on out for one of their lectures. And at various times they offered food. Sometimes they used the euphemism tea room, which of course is used during Prohibition so that people could come and get alcohol.
Right.
And by the early 30s, the Dill Pickle Club had basically kind of run its course. But it was, I think that's the other kind of thinking about the ephemeral nature of cities as people had moved on to other things. Some people had moved on to New York, some of the poets and other writers, and the moment had passed. So it was very, you know, 15 years or so in the city's history, but a pretty fruitful period and one we're so fortunate to have at the Newbury, all these documents and handbills that give a sense of what was it like to be. I personally would love to see a play or production, you know, kind of speculative based on what would it be like a night at the Dill Pickle Club. I think it'd be a wonderful project.
Yeah. And it's very political inherently.
Yeah. Inherently very political. And lots of conversations about, you know, difficult topics, sex education, role of women in society. And it's not to say that other folks weren't having these conversations. These were, but they really got a lot of interesting people. University of Chicago professors showed up to debate professors from Northwestern. So you did get, you had high and low there, which I think increasingly unusual in cities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you have a lot of other things with you. What else was fascinating to you about the Dill Pickle Club?
Well, as I was looking through them, they're such an interesting set of items, their handbills and flyers and programs. And one of the other ones that really spoke to me was a promised lecture, and this was kind of a common topic for them, basically to stir the pot. If we think of how people stir the pot today, an online announcement, viral content. This announcement from 1923, possibly 1928, exact provenance unknown, promises a lecture on sex worship in boldface type by Mr. Samuel W. Ball, noted scholar and scientist and man of the world, each lecture illustrated.
Oh,
you would imagine projected images at this point. And of course, in the keeping with the hyperbole, they also promise it is the most amazing series of lecture ever given in Chicago. So
most amazing.
Yeah, there can be without peer, basically. Like that's kind of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the back of this particular document also features upcoming attractions. June 20th, The Slave Woman, conversations about sexual ideas, about the formation of the world. Following in the fall, phallic worship, the arrow. So they didn't shy away from the difficult topics. And, you know, we don't have any sense of how many people were in attendance. We don't have, you know, big or small data on any of these things, but it's kind of interesting to speculate. It was a small space. It wasn't a huge, you know, auditorium theater type of place, but you can imagine there were some lively conversations that took place.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mention it, how ephemeral this kind of is, and yet it's definitely has a continuation to today's sort of
People dialogue. Are fascinated by it. I mean, you know, I haven't looked on another arbiter of our times, you know, to see if there are YouTube videos about it, reenactments from the Dill Pickle Club, but it wouldn't shock me. I mean, as I say, there's a group in Portland, Oregon that publishes these little chapbooks inspired by the Dill Pickle Club's kind of wanderings and programs. And, you know, it's hard to think about in a city that's changing so much. And, you know, of course, the conversations about gentrification in Chicago, like, you know, where can these places still exist? You know, low barriers to entry in terms of rent, you know, reusable spaces, you know, kind of what will be the next place where this will happen or be able to happen in the city. So,
That's an interesting point you bring about place. So the way communities interact with their spaces. And so the Dill Pickle Club had a physical space, but also came in and out of it. So how do people like the Dill Pickle Club impact the urban infrastructure?
It's interesting. You know, you can't point to anything. They don't have an honorary street sign. They don't have a piece of public art in the Clark and Dearborn station, which would be close to where the Pickle Club was. So it is more something that really exists in kind of the ether surrounding that aspect of Chicago's cultural history. Because most of the buildings they would have inhabited, and I've been doing some recent research on this for another project, using these archives and a couple books published during the period about the Near North community, is most of it's gone, either demolished for other buildings in the 60s and 70s. And the other place they talk about, you know, the tower in the Tower Town, which is this neighborhood they inhabited, is the original Chicago Water Tower, which was surrounded by other older small buildings. And all of those buildings are gone as well, too. A lot of notable artists used to live there as well. And, of course, all of this is mostly gone, a function of how cities grow and change, right? Replaced with, not surprisingly, skyscrapers and, you know, probably the other famous water tower, the Vertical Mall Water Tower place. So looking for the actual buildings is very tough. There's not much left of it right in our area. But I always like to see that the spirit lives on in different groups and organizations that were inspired by these initial kind of pioneers in the city.
We're talking about built environment and the way people interact with it and the relationship to ephemeral life in cities, so like conversations and whatnot. But to what extent do those come together? Like, how is the built environment also ephemeral? Is my main question.
Well, if you think about cities inherently are always in a state of renewal and rebirth, and any city that doesn't do this will not continue to be a successful city. We value historic districts, buildings that speak to the character and culture of our places, but, you know, all that is solid melts into air at some point or another. A good example of this is the Illinois Central Station, which used to be on Roosevelt Road, which was demolished in 1974. Chicago, railroad capital of the United States, then and now, really since certainly the late 19th century. And by 1925, there were six major passenger train stations in and around the loop. Testimony to the fact that there were hundreds of intercity trains that came in and out of the city every day, taking people all over. Illinois Central Station had been finished in 1893 to serve the World's Fair, and it did a very good job of that and helped serve the World's Fair. And of course, over its 80-odd years of history, it also became very well known as being a place where African Americans coming up from the South deposited their bags and started a new life. Mm-hmm. So lots of different moments. The building was not beloved Famously, Lewis Sullivan had some very harsh words about the building in his book Kindergarten Chats. And he refers to this building, which is, you know, a ponderous limestone building, many of them still in and around the loop in Chicago, like it, not for trains, obviously. He said he referred to the building as this droll and fantastical parody upon logic, this finical mass of difficulties, this web of contradiction, this blatant fallacy, this repellent and indurated mess, this canker on the tongue of natural speech. Why does not the lake engulf it? Why does not the fire from heaven consume it? Is there no sane tribunal on earth? It must be that the lake is too busy and that the Lord of heaven is too busy. So, Lewis Sullivan.
Harsh words.
Harsh words. Some might call it the sickest of burns. Some might call it that. So he was not a fan, but the building, you know, served its purpose well. And there were proposals over time, especially in the second decade of the 20th century, for the older building, finished in 1893, to be torn down and reconstructed anew. And this is going on as we think of kind of the transformation of the built environment with conversations about why don't we consolidate all intercity passenger train activity at one station. It will make it easier. It seems the more efficient way. Of course, we know that humans and private companies like large railroad companies don't always get along or agree, so it never happened. Mm-hmm. And planning for the demolition started in 1972 after the last train left. And the question was, what do you do with this hulking monstrosity? People were leaving Chicago at that point, tens of thousands, throughout the 70s and 80s. So there wasn't a conversation of let's build new condos, which now the site is, you know, there's a couple skyscrapers, residential condo skyscrapers on the site. In the 70s, there was no one talking about, they're talking about what to do with this old hulking monstrosity. And Illinois Central obviously had just gotten out of the passenger railroad business and Amtrak had been created the year before. So there wasn't much that was going to be due. There was very little interest in repurposing the building.
Sounds sort of like the opposite of if you build it, they will come.
Right.
If they don't use it, there's no point in having a building, right?
Yeah. And I mean, it had definitely, you know, it was very well worn. There were some concerns about its structural integrity. And, the only thing that was really preserved when it was demolished in 1974 were the actual platforms, which were used for three more decades just for regular metro trains. So part of that was preserved, but the building was demolished. And of course, there were lots of interesting conversations in the files here at the Newbury for the Illinois Central Railroad about what should we do with some of the stuff. There's a couple internal memos. I'm looking at one right now asking for what should we do about the bronze tablets that commemorated the people who lost their lives in the service during World War II. And other kind of aspects. There's a letter, interestingly enough, there's a letter in the files from a Dr. George Feinstein from Brooklyn who writes in, I should put it in, writes in by hand. It's a letter from June 6, 1974, who says, I have read that the Illinois Central is demolishing the Central Station in Chicago. This building includes a clock tower having a tower clock with a gravity escapement. I am interested in and study clocks. Thus, I would like to know whether this clock is for sale, and if so, who should be contacted concerning this matter. So a nice polite letter from the good doctor in Brooklyn, and he receives a reply from the director of public relations from the railroad who says it has already been sold in part. So a little too late on that one.
Was there any – so it seems like there's people asking for objects from the building. Was there any controversy about the demolition?
There was some controversy. You know, the idea at that point, obviously Chicago in the previous 10 or 15 years had kind of developed a civic preservation consciousness. Richard Nickel, who of course lost his life documenting the Stock Exchange building, was part of this process along with the demolition of the Garrick Theater in the Loop, where people said we need to preserve that which is going away in Chicago. I don't think there was... Given that we were in a kind of a trough of passenger rail service, there wasn't that much concern about it. And certainly the Illinois Central, which was then the Illinois Central Gulf Railroad, because it had swallowed up another railroad, was interested in kind of sloughing off unproductive assets. Mm-hmm. And certainly maintaining this massive building was... there wasn't a kind of hue and cry that there had been about the stock exchange building, et cetera. But it was interesting because 5 years before this, kind of in the southwest corner of the loop, the Grand Central Station, which is used by the Baltimore and Ohio, was demolished in 1969, and that is still a vacant lot. So, you know, the idea was basically these are private assets, tear them down, and that's it. Well, that way we don't have to maintain them or think about it. Success stories, of course, in Chicago include Dearborn Station, which is in the South Loop. And famously, so that's still there. And it was developed, of course, into, you know, middle class apartments in the park and public school later. And of course, the building's now retail. So there are some success stories in that. And of course, we are lucky to still have Union Station. But yeah, the story of the Illinois Central Station is a fascinating one. And this folder in front of me, which has, 150 or so documents, ephemera, Tribune articles, internal memos, really gives you the sense of complexity of all of it. A loss, I think, in some ways for Chicago, but, you know, it's kind of, this is again how cities grow and change. And of course, we're still faced with transit challenges in the city, you know, extension of the Red Line, how can we improve Union Station, and so on.
So you mentioned there are like plaques and different objects from the train station. Do you know where any of those objects have gone to? I know there's like bits of the building marble that are scattered throughout the city.
Yeah, it's interesting. The whereabouts of the clock face, to the best of my knowledge, are not known. The most visible landmark for folks who are visiting Chicago, interested in how we commemorate the past, is at the southern end of Grant Park near Roosevelt Road, near a set of public art sculptures. There are two massive limestone blocks from the building, from the Illinois Central building, finished in 1893 with a very small and modest plaque next to another plaque about the blues in Chicago, which kind of makes sense. A lot of African Americans, well-known musicians, including Buddy Guy, came up on the train and got off at Roosevelt Road or 12th Street Station and started their new careers. Here's a funny thing for those of you involved in historic preservation, is it was first proposed that those blocks be installed in 1976. They weren't installed until 2015, 2016. So things take time in cities sometimes too. And it's interesting because you walk by them and most people don't give them a second glance, but this is kind of our one literally our piece of the station is right across from where it used to be. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the piece that's about people can actually see.
It's interesting that some of the stuff may have been repurposed, but you have this preserved as a memorial to what city used to be like.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's changing all the time.
Well, and Jamie, I'm reminded that we were talking about the Garrick Theater in the Loop, mm-hmm. which was demolished and kind of set off a renewed interest in preservation. And you can walk around Old Town and Lincoln Park and see chunks of the Garrick Theater in, you know, decorative elements in the front of homes. The most famous element for folks who are interested is over the entrance to the Second City Theater.
Oh, really?
On North Wells. That's a piece of the Garrick Theater. So, you know, there's a huge market for kind of architectural artifacts, number of stores in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see these pieces turn up in other places as reminders of the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that some of these pieces have an aura around them from previous, like with the Garrick Theater and Second City, there seems to be a theatrical connection at least. So what's the attitude towards the objects from the built environment that have disappeared and are repurposed?
I think it's interesting. I think there is that people are interested to seek that kind of meaningful connection with the past. And I think folks, you know, we've seen an explosion of it. Non-archival places, you know, Atlas Obscura and other websites. So there's definitely an intense interest in it. I think also becomes a practical consideration is some of these fragments are just so big. They're hard to move. I think people like those kind of reminders, those kind of small segments. One of my favorite items is actually that I have is a piece of a brick that was torn down by the University of Chicago. It was a residential building south of the Midway, and it was one of the last remaining apartment buildings built for the World's Fair along the Midway. And I remember when they're demolishing it, just, you know, it's like, oh, here's a brick. I'm going to take a little piece of this. Probably because I also had friends who lived in the building. So I was like, wow, just like, take a little chunk.
Take a chunk. Interesting. It seems like there's a lot of ways that people interact with cities that are repurposing of those of the city itself. And it's constantly changing and becoming something different at every moment. Do you think that with the, we think about the Dill Pickle Club and like the destruction of this giant train station and so the repurposing of different architectural artifacts, like what do you think they share as a like urban studies theme to make a broad sweeping statement about life?
No. These are the statements we seek, and we hope we can make those connections. I think there is a kind of a communal shared history of that, because they are pieces of the city. Some of them are quite ephemeral, and some of them, you know, might persist, especially if they have some kind of philanthropic support. You think about the role of arts in cities, the role of transportation in cities. But there's also those kind of practical considerations, right? We can't have an old wooden omnibus rolling around taking people when we'd much better have the State Street subway or some other type of transit service. I think people, because Chicago in particular has such a strong sense of history, there's that kind of desire to connect with that. But as also, as I like to tell people, anyone who listens, students, people, places where I give my talks, Chicago is also really good at capitalism, which requires creative destruction. And that is usually a literal destruction of older buildings. And I fall back on the example of, you know, the neighborhood that surrounds the Newberry Library, the Gold Coast, and the Near North communities. Gold Coast, to me, is always a great example of a place that preserves its value very well. Whether other cities have gone through, other parts of Chicago have gone through dramatic changes, Pilsen, Hyde Park, Woodlawn, the Gold Coast holds its value. So for me, it's an interesting place. And I think cities, getting back to my main point, kind of cities do require this kind of constant renewal and rebirth. So I always think it's exciting. Part of what I might do is my work as a professor and writer of history is to kind of connect people with those stories. And I think it's great that there are things like mobile apps and websites, and I use them. I'm not a Luddite. Promise I'm not a Luddite. But also kind of those smaller stories, and they lead to a bigger truth. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But it makes places richer the more we know about them. And coming to a place like the Newberry, where you can really feel that communion with the documents, you sit there, you look. Sure, you can bring yourself into the reading room, but you feel like you're in a different state of mind. It's kind of, I love it. I love it. And to me, like, just to look through these things really gets me excited, and kind of also allows me to slow down a little bit and focus in.
Mm-hmm. And you can also see simultaneously the people interacting with the city and the way that people's use of the city changes the actual infrastructure of it.
I mean, even some of these petitions the Illinois Central Railroad file, which I'm looking at about the demolition of the 12th Street Station, you know, people's petitions, you know, kind of a chunk of the building, kind of a bit of the clock. People care about these buildings. People care about these structures, and telling their stories remains tremendously valuable.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for talking about urbanology today.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Max Grinnell's writings on cities have appeared in the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, the Guardian, Urban Geography, and a host of other publications. You can follow his shorter missives on Twitter, @TheUrbanologist, and his longer meditations can be found on his professional website, theurbanologist.com. Shelf Life is produced by the Newberry Library in Chicago, Illinois. If you have any thoughts or questions about anything you just heard, please let us know at facebook.com/Newberry Library. Thanks for listening.